Just when I started to feel bad about not being that great with my retirement plans, some French guy loses $7 billion in the stock market. And suddenly I feel like a genius, a financial genius. It's a Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett with a face for radio and a voice for print. What a great show coming up. Speaking of the financial story, we will have to ask that of Catherine Austin Fitz. She's one of our most popular guests in 2007 and shaping up to be the same here in 2008. I want to just get a few minutes with her coming up before our main guest, Michael D'Antonio, next hour. And the story of the space program in 1957, he's written this very detailed, very interesting and honest look at all of the unusual aspects of the space program when it first got started. And I say that in like in contrast to the rocket program, which had been ongoing. But I'll let Michael D'Antonio talk about it coming up next hour, about the ball, the dog, and the monkey, and this very special year in both United States and human history, 1957 and into 1958, when the space program was, as you might guess, I would say, launched. And we'll talk more about that coming up next hour. Great new book out that commemorated the 50th anniversary of Sputnik when that was launched 50 years ago, back last fall. So Michael D'Antonio next hour, but Catherine Austin Fitz until then, and we'll be talking with her coming up about both this this tapeworm economy theory she's been talking about on Coast to Coast AM, how that pertains to these the moves with the Fed to lower the interest rate and with the sudden rebate program, and then also too, I just have to ask her, can one guy, I mean, she's a Wall Street person, can just one guy lose $7 billion for a company? And a fairly low-level guy at that? I think that doesn't add up to me somehow, but I don't know everything about it like she does, so we'll talk to her after a little crypto news next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Catherine Austin Fitz coming up in just a minute or two. The couple of big news stories, kind of mainstream news stories you've no doubt heard by now, that Barack Obama was the big winner in South Carolina today in preparation for the big Super Tuesday sort of mini primary in the first week of February. And already, of course, the political posturing is already beginning. But it is curious to note that on the Republican side, the number of people who came on the air on January 2nd and said, the day that I guess our January 1st night or into January 2nd, when we were talking to professional predictors, you know, people like, you know, Gerald Celente and other people who are tracking trends and are otherwise sort of prognosticating in one way or another, how many times John McCain's name came up then? And even though it appeared as though Huckabee might have more momentum, where it seemed like in some ways of looking at it, McCain was kind of out of it. And suddenly, even in Florida, which was going to be sort of a slam dunk for Rudy Giuliani, John McCain's name is at the top of both that and the national polls. And that story is just going to get more interesting as we get closer to Super Tuesday, or as they're now starting to call it, Super Duper Tuesday, although I don't know why it's more duper than it ever was before. It's Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett, and a large U.S. spy satellite has lost power and propulsion and could hit Earth in late February or March, government officials said on Saturday. That leads crypto news here for tonight. The satellite, which can no longer be controlled, could contain hazardous materials, but they're not saying what kind of hazardous materials, and they're not saying exactly where on the planet it might come down. Officials with the government spoke on condition of anonymity because the information is classified as secret. Doesn't that make you feel good? Appropriate government agencies are monitoring the situation, said Gordon Jandro, a spokesman for the National Security Council. Numerous satellites over the year have come out of orbit and fallen harmlessly. We're looking at potential options to mitigate any possible damage this satellite might cause. He would not comment on whether it's possible for the satellite to be perhaps shot down by a missile. He said it would be inappropriate to discuss any specifics at this time. But I think we can only hope that it might actually hit something or hit somewhere, as long as it doesn't hit anybody, per se. But they almost never do. Falling satellites are almost always a disappointment. You get all excited and then nothing. There's all this talk about what could happen, and then they end up landing harmlessly in the ocean or a desert or something. But at heart, I'm still an optimist, so I'm going to hold on to my hope that this sagging spy satellite will crash, like, onto the stage of the Academy Awards during one of those lame dance numbers or something. Wouldn't that be cool? That's early in March, right? What if a spy satellite landed right into the middle of a Republican debate? And the only surviving candidate that could still talk was Ron Paul, because he wasn't invited while all the other guys were in the hospital or something. Take that, Fox News. I've still got $5 on that asteroid hitting Mars. Remember, the probability of a collision is 1 in 75, but scientists are excited about that possibility. If it happens, that impact would occur, remember, on January 30th, 2008, around 2:55 Pacific time. But if I were a Martian, I'd probably be just as disappointed about that asteroid next week, too. Still, I'd be crossing my Martian fingers if I had fingers on Mars, which reminds me, remember that photo taken by the Mars rover Spirit that was released this week showing what appeared to be a Martian man or woman behind a rock? Well, yesterday in an email update, a NASA spokesman said that the quote-unquote man on Mars is actually a 2-inch tall sedimentary rock that has been eroded by the wind, the Martian wind. I think it looks like Bigfoot in the Patterson-Gimlin film. You know what I'm talking about? According to CNET News, some observers of the Mars man actually see a Mars made in the image. In particular, they see a comparison of the Mars man in that recently released photo with the image of Hans Christian Andersen's Little Mermaid, the statue that overlooks the harbor in Copenhagen. And it really does eerily kind of look like it if you've seen him. I'll put those links up on my blog coming up a little bit later on. It might be in the eye of the beholder or in the ear of the behearer, for that matter. If you heard the story out of the Daily Iberian, okay, comes out of Louisiana, St. Martinville. These are the words of Kenneth Hickson, who wrote, "Some Louisiana ghost hunters are not ready to call a house they investigated in St. Martinville haunted just yet, but they are reporting one unexplained phenomenon." This story is on the website at coasttocoastam.com. On January 5th, the group Louisiana Spirits was called to investigate a house owned by Michelle and J.D. Kirkwood, which is one of the homes. Quote, "We were very eager to investigate the house, especially after all of the strange happenings reported by the homeowners," said Brad Duplessis, founder of Louisiana Spirits. Such happenings included footsteps being heard upstairs, strange noises being heard, and an upstairs door that opened on its own. Duplessis said that they began to review the audio and video recordings days after the investigation, and they all noticed something that could not be explained. He said they came across a distinct voice that was not their own. "One of our investigators was doing audio work in an attempt to capture EVPs or electronic voice phenomenon," he said. "Our investigator was asking questions out loud. Nothing was heard at the time the question was asked, but when the audio recording was played back, you can hear a very loud and distinct no from an unknown individual." Duplessis expects to upload that recording to the group's website in the coming days. It is not there yet, or at least it wasn't earlier today when I checked. They may have put it up since this evening. As I've explained before, I've seen a UFO, and I've been on a few ghost hunts, but I've never actually seen a ghost, and I'd really like to. I hope I live long enough to have one of those classic Scooby-Doo encounters with a ghost, except it would actually be a ghost and not the caretaker, old man Blithers or whatever. So anyway, how long do you plan on living? Do you see this story on the website? According to The Independent, a genetically engineered organism that lives 10 times longer than normal has been created by scientists in California. It is the greatest extension of longevity yet achieved by researchers investigating the scientific nature of aging. If this work could ever be translated into humans, it would mean that one day we could see people living for 800 years. 800 years. Like, we don't have enough commercials for Viagra on TV already. Can you imagine 750 years of your life of, if you're up for the moment, but the moment isn't up for you? Yikes. Anyway, 800 would have been the number of years that I would have thought I would have had to have lived in order to have ever seen my name included in a crossword puzzle. And I don't know if it got reported earlier in the week or not on the website. I missed it if it did. But it's true. As it turns out, somebody out there who listens to Coast, who designs crossword puzzles for Hemispheres, the magazine, the in-flight magazine for United Airlines, included me as a clue for 73 across. 73 across is a three-letter word, and the clue is Fleming or Puttit. I'll put the link up on my blog here in a few minutes, and you can find it. So what's my theory as to why I was included with such a notable literary figure as Ian Fleming, creator of James Bond, Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, as well as a legendary figure in espionage himself? Well, to make the clue harder, I think that's why they threw my name in there. Somebody might see three-letter word associated with Fleming and immediately think Ian, but with Punnett next to it, it might confuse people just a bit to make it more interesting. Either that or the designer of the crossword puzzle wanted to use Punnett as a clue, but decided to add Fleming next to it for fear that after seeing Punnett 73 across alone, everybody would try to fill in the three-letter word ASS. So they thought maybe that would help. Finally, from the Independent UK, when scientists found out that chimps had better memories than students, there were unkind comments about the caliber of the human competition that they faced. But now an ape has gone one better, trouncing British memory champion Ben Pridmore, a 7-year-old male brought up in captivity in Japan, did three times as well as Mr. Pridmore at a computer game, which involved remembering the position of numbers on a screen. And that's no small accomplishment. The 30-year-old accountant from Derby is capable of memorizing the order of a shuffled pack of cards in under 30 seconds. And the ape kicked his butt. And by the way, for those of you keeping track, that's the second story in just 1 week about how chimps have better memories than humans. Or is that the third? I can't remember. Where's my banana? So Catherine Austin Fitz is with us, and it's always a pleasure to have her. Of course, a couple of big news stories right up her alley this evening. So we'll start with where we left off earlier in the hour. Good evening, Catherine.
Good evening, Ian. It's nice to be back.
Always a pleasure. Catherine is a former Reagan administration economist with the Federal Housing Authority, and then later a Wall Street wizard, and continues to be a consultant. And you run not a hedge fund, is it?
I was Assistant Secretary of Housing in the Bush administration.
Oh, did I say Reagan? Sorry.
And I was lead financial advisor to HUD in the Clinton administration. And I was a partner at a Wall Street firm, and now I'm an investment advisor.
Well, you see, and yet I had this chimp next to me, and he was telling me the whole time I got it wrong. I was looking over, the chimp was...
You know, I have to tell you a chimp story. Can I
please do.
When I was a partner at Dillon Reed, I had a wonderful partner named Peter Flanagan, and Peter got upset one day at a dinner of some of the board members and admitted that he had done a study, an analysis of how much money we would have made if we had chimpanzees in the trading... in the trading spots during a 10-year period versus the traders.
Right.
They said we would have made more money if we had chimpanzees because they would have cost a lot less. And most of our profits just came from Fed policy.
Well, I don't know why that doesn't surprise me. I don't see how a chimp could do any worse than lose $7 billion. So there's this story about this French guy who is, I guess, a British national originally, but he... he's being, you know, investigated. He's currently under arrest. They're talking about fines and jail time because of what he did with this security firm.
But what they allege he did.
Well, what they allege he did.
What they allege he did.
I hear that story.
The lone assassin has been replaced by the lone trader.
Okay, that's what I'm thinking. It's $7 billion. What low-level guy has access to $7 billion of the company's funds without them knowing it?
Well, in theory, I mean, you could construct a theoretical case that it's possible. But I must tell you, even with complex derivatives, it's hard to understand how somebody could keep such a position obfuscated for that long. So I'm skeptical, but I don't know if the truth will ever come out. There was a similar case, or there has been a similar case, you know, sort of every year for the last 10 years, but there was one in 1995 that was attributed to a Singapore trader who took Dan Barings.
Right, and he actually did go on the lam. He actually did try to get away, and they finally caught him, right?
Well, there was a great movie that they made out of that where, you know, the guy was clearly guilty of some, you know, some huge amount of money, but nothing like attributed to him. And then when the whole thing cascaded down, you know, the amount that was stuck on him was much more, and he kept wondering. You know, in the movie, they say, well, you know, what other stolen money was consolidated in with this? So
right, who else rolled their losses conveniently into his?
I always wonder what the real story is. I mean, it's not good in any way, but what is the real story here?
Well, maybe it'll help then to recoup that $7 billion that we'll all be getting a tax rebate of $600 a person or something.
Can you imagine? You've got American households in I think I told you this story, in fiscal 2004 had a $350 billion operating deficit. So that means their income was less than their outgoing expenses by $350 billion. So I have no idea what it is this year. It's probably worse. And to think that in a couple of months, $600 or $1,200 is going to make a difference when you've got that kind of shortfall.
Well, and the order is to spend it. I mean, the order is you have to spend it in order to fix the economy. So,
well, the problem is for most families, it's already spent.
Right. I mean, in an act of, the act of rebellion would be to save it. I mean, how backward does that sound?
Well, except for this, you know, food prices are at a minimum up 10 to 20%. So, you know, this year. So how are they going to save it?
Right. I mean, but I just mean, if you put it in the bank and didn't spend it at all, you're supposed to go out and kind of blow it. You're supposed to go, like, use the first 20 bucks to buy some liquor or something, get drunk, then go out and spend the rest of it. And that's supposed to stimulate the
economy. Here's my favorite act of rebellion. How about if on April 15th, everybody just filed an extension and said, we've had it with this kind of behavior. We're just filing an extension. Why? If we give you the money, you're just going to give it to the bank. So we'll file an extension. We'll all wait till October.
Well, and the thing, yeah, when they dangle this out here for June and they say, well, it's the stimulus package is getting passed now, but nobody will get a check until June. There doesn't seem to be any short term stimulus benefit anyway. I mean, it's all more psychological than anything else. Okay.
Yeah.
So I want you to hang on, and I want to get into how this plays into the tapeworm economy, okay? Because I have a feeling, and I want to ask, actually, I have a bunch of questions like this one. We'll get to it coming up in the hour ahead. But I missed your last appearance on Coast to Coast. And so did you have any, could you recap for us real quickly, if you had any economic predictions for 2008? Did you make any when you were on right around the...
The average family's household food and energy prices are going to go up a lot.
Oh, go up a lot. Okay.
A lot.
Works for me. So a lot is all I think is what we're feeling already. In fact, that does seem like it's kind of an inevitability. These gas prices and other things have actually sort of had a down period, sort of a lull.
People who've never been interested in gardening or in bicycling are going to get interested.
Okay, very good. Well, we'll get to that, but there's some other economic news, and the question of the tapeworm economy comes up a lot. Catherine Austin Fitz, one of our most responded to guests in 2007. And then remember, coming up next hour, a ball, a dog, and a monkey. Keeping with the theme of the discussion so far, Michael D'Antonio has a book out. about 1957, this very pivotal year in the space program, and what was really happening behind the scenes. You don't want to miss it coming up next hour on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. You are shooting you the numbers in case you want to join the conversation with Catherine Austin Fitz just in the remainder of the hour that we have with her before Michael D'Antonio coming up next hour. Okay, so I got everything up on the blog. I put the links up to the United Airlines crossword puzzle that I think must have been done by some coastie somewhere that they included my name as 73 across. It was pretty cool. That may be the best thing that ever happens to me in my career ever. I don't think anything cooler has ever happened before anyway. It could all be downhill from there. So thank you, whoever it was that designed that or suggested that to the designer. And also, too, I don't want to come off as a snob or anything. So let me rephrase something. If you're going to get a rebate check coming up, don't get me wrong. You know, $600 is $600. It's to me. It is to you, I'm sure. And if for a household, for a married couple to get $1,200 or, you know, that plus $300 per kid, you know, that can add up. And I'm not saying it's meaningless to receive the money. I just think it seems meaningless to think of that as a way that's really going to stimulate the economy. That's all. It's a nice little kiss. In some cases, maybe sort of even a wet kiss back from the government. I'm not sold on the idea that that's suddenly going to get us out of this slump. But partially, that's due to the way in which Catherine Austin Fitz has me thinking about how the world works with her theory on the tapeworm economy. And we'll talk about that next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Hey, Catherine Austin Fitz, why don't we start with a quick recap on your theory of the tapeworm economy? And since I did such a great job remembering everything about your bio earlier this hour, why don't we have you explain it?
Okay. The way a tapeworm works in your body, Ian, is it injects into you a chemical that makes you crave what's good for the tapeworm and bad for you. And so you proceed to support the tapeworm in draining you and your body. And so when you apply that to economics, it's a system where you have a group of insiders who are always draining subsidy from those who are outsiders. And so the outsiders steadily lose while the insiders grow stronger and stronger. So it's a parasitic system.
And the parasitic system would explain why at the very top, an oligarchy of wealthy get wealthier while they drain from the lowest percentage of income.
And the governmental budgets and credit are a very important way that was happening. During the break, I thought I'd compare the $600 or $1,200 for a couple in the tax stimulus with the amount of money an American household has lost in the last 10 years from money missing from the federal budget, policies to industrialize, manipulation of the gold market, general inflation from bank bailouts. And just on the back of the envelope, I calculated that at $100,000 to $200,000 per household.
Mm. So,
missing money, you've got $14,000 per person for a family of five. That's $50,000 that's missing from the federal government.
And it's going somewhere. I mean,
it's going somewhere.
And your belief is it's going where?
You know something? What I can document is that it's missing. I mean, we have, you know, government audits that report $4 trillion plus missing, and now through the Iraq war. And what that means is the big banks are continuing to execute security sales and bank transactions, when the government is operating outside of the law, and certainly way outside of the Constitution.
All right. So as you looked at the earlier in the week when the Fed dropped the interest rate, I kept thinking, and I know they dropped the interest rate because they knew that the international markets were going to be really hard on the U.S. when the market opened up the day after Martin Luther King Day. And I thought, well, isn't that a little bit like dropping the interest rate? Isn't it like taking somebody out and getting them drunk before the big exam because they knew they're going to fail the exam, so they might as well at least be drunk while they did it?
Well, remember, if I'm a bank and I can borrow money at the Fed window or at the market, very inexpensively, and I can turn around and at the same time buy treasuries, long treasury bonds at a much higher rate, then I can literally print profit.
Right.
And that's how we floated the banks out in 1991 at the end of the last housing bubble. And now, you know, it's the same thing. So I remember I told you the story of having lunch with a banker from one of the largest banks during that period. They had $110 billion of long treasuries on their balance sheet. They were just printing $6 billion of pure profit a year. Now, you know, if small businesses and small farmers could do the same thing, it would be a very different picture. But
it would be a very different economy. Yeah. You know, by the way, you were talking about famous lunches you've had, and it reminded me of the last time you were on and you told the story about when the guy said, do you want to meet an actual alien from outer space? And we talked about that off and on throughout the evening, and I got so much mail about that as though it was as though somehow I was making up that story. Like, you, and I'm afraid
the
that
story,
they missed.
The story is written up in, I've written an article called What's Up in the Black Budget, but, you know, it's important to stress. I mean, my big question, the reason I said no was, you know, it was a very sincere, I felt it was a very insincere, you know, my big question is, are these guys just playing a game and trying to set
right.
me up?
And they just want to make you look bad. No, it was really more the story about when you went to that meeting and you were all sitting around with all these high-ranking people in the government.
Well, but
and
I think that story is irrelevant to what's going on right now.
Oh,
in other
sure
words,
it
I
is.
Just, you know.
I'm sure it is, but I'm just saying that it was really interesting. I keep thinking about that story and how much I would have loved to have been a fly on the wall in that meeting. Let's get Tom. He's in Spruce Knob, West Virginia, for Catherine Austin Fitz on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, Tom, I got to do this. Hey, Tom's got a question or a comment about the tapeworm economy and some of the changes this week. Go ahead, Tom.
It's really great to talk to you and your guest tonight. You have a beautiful voice, young lady.
Yeah, that's coming from Barry White. So that's good.
I'm a permanently paralyzed and disabled law enforcement officer, put 24 years in. And there are over 1 million of us in America. We live in the poverty or below the poverty line. And I've seen everything I've seen in the past 7+ years has been cut back for anybody in our position. So, it's really great to hear all the rallying around about everybody getting a check back. But for the 1 million plus of us in America who've protected and served 24/7, we'll never see any of that money. So how can we bankroll $150 billion that we have to borrow to give this kind of dangling piece of candy in the air to people, which really is not going to do any substance when we're spending $500,000 every half minute for an unjust war in the Mideast?
Well, that you, and I will let me just put the word unjust aside for the moment and address the rest of your question, Tom, because I think, and first of all, thank you for your service and sorry about what happened to you. But I do keep thinking about how much we're spending in Iraq versus what kind of shape our economy is here. Catherine, do you have a thought on that?
Well, we have a federal credit machinery that essentially issues significant amounts of currency and significant amount of treasury securities and then use military and force to have investors around the world hold that paper. So we have, you know, if the U.S. dollar, if our military and our ability to force went away, the U.S. dollar would probably drop 90% overnight. So we have a system that's increasingly built on force. And that process of inflation is one in which the insiders can keep up, but the outsiders are getting drained. And the group of people that the person who just came in on the call, your listener, described is a perfect example of highly productive, very responsible members of society who are caught in that pincer movement.
Right, and so. Within a couple of days, you have the story of the $7 billion loss by the Frenchman. You have the Fed lowering their interest rate 3/4%. Plus, it ended up with a roller coaster week that came out slightly ahead on Wall Street, but it all seemed kind of artificial. It doesn't really seem like it's based on anything we're doing right. It's just kind of the gamesmanship of the economy.
And there was another thing that's been happening, and I've been trying to put copies of the legal motions up on my blog. We're starting to see state pension funds and municipalities suing big lenders over the housing bubble bust. And in the process, a great deal of information is coming out. It's still tip of the iceberg. You've got Baltimore suing Wells Fargo. You've got Cleveland suing 21 big lenders. The New York pension funds is part of the countrywide consolidated lawsuit now. You've got the Ohio pension fund suing Freddie Mac.
Right.
But we're starting to see a huge spat of lawsuits, even the lenders suing each other. And from that, information is coming out about what the true costs of sort of the fraudulent inducement of America is, in real detail on what it's costing homeowners, what it's costing municipalities, what it's costing state pension funds. We haven't even seen anything. Most of the state pension fund lawsuits have been about losses in the equity portfolio. The big losses are going to be in the state investment pools and in the fixed income pools and the pension funds, and we haven't even begun to touch that yet. But it's these lawsuits are getting very informative and showing and detailing in legal documents a pattern of systemic fraud, which is breathtaking.
And yet we can't still see the big picture yet of the systemic fraud. I mean, we're getting a glimpse of it.
There was a recent, you'll see it up on my blog, there was a recent article about a private Zagat survey that was commissioned that showed 10% of the people in America, 10% of the population are either leaving the country or making arrangements to leave the country or making arrangements for a backup home outside the country in case they need to leave the country.
Wow.
Yeah, that tells me, you know.
Okay. Yeah. See, that's I actually got an email from somebody who said, is it all right if they use the $1,200 check from the government to help fund moving to Iceland or Australia? And I thought, I don't think that's what the government's hoping people are going to do with the money, is scoot. Let's get to Garrett in Seattle on Coast to Coast AM for Catherine Austin Fitz. Go ahead, Garrett.
Hey, Ian. Hey, Catherine. Great topic. I am a true conservative, hopefully. One of the things that I've been studying and paying attention to over the years is that watching the price of oil and hearing the Fed's inflation rate, it doesn't line up for one thing. That's one of my points. And I wanted to ask you what the true inflation rate was with the cost of fuel included in the inflation rate. But the other thing is that the price of oil with the U.S. dollar, to me, all that says is they've been using the euro to measure the price of oil, and the only reason oil is almost $100 a barrel is because the weakness of the dollar compared to even the Canadian dollar and the euro, it's just a translation of that dollar amount. Is that a true
analysis? I couldn't agree more. I think the price of oil and the price of gold and other, you know, tangible assets, the increase in price reflects much more a falling dollar than a change in value of those commodities. So a lot of the huge boom we're watching in commodities, and I believe we're just in the business in the beginning of that, is the drop in the dollar. Now, the even though the euro is stronger, we're seeing huge increase in monetary, in M3 and monetary aggregates worldwide. I've have various newsletter writers I use who are estimating that the dollar expanded, or M3 was up here 15 to 27% last year, but if you look worldwide, it's the same all around the world. So you've got big monetary expansion and inflation to deal with the debt bubble worldwide.
And are there any more moves by major U.S. corporations to go offshore, as we had seen sort of a trend of that for a little while? Have you noticed any more of that?
I think a policy was begun, and I try and describe this. I have a long, big article that's a case study on tapeworm economics called Dylan Reed and the Aristocracy of Stock Profits. I think a decision was made to deindustrialize the United States, same as they did in Russia, and we're watching a long-term process of of real deindustrialization and significant move of resources, you know, and disinvestment. I mean, we've watched huge transfer of capital under the sort of the umbrella of this housing bubble and debt bubble. And so basically, you know, I told the story of the pension fund leader who said to me in 1997, they've given up on the country, they're moving all the money out starting in the fall, which is when the $4 trillion started to go missing from the federal government.
Right.
So there's, you know, Ian, I've just finished watching season 3 of The Wire.
Yeah.
Have you seen that?
I have a friend who's really into it. He tells me about all the episodes. He loves it.
You know, HBO sometimes has done more, I think, with fiction to explain what's going on in America. But you've got a story of a union leader who's basically doing dirty on the dock so he can get the money to get lobbyists to stop the disinvestment in the piers in Baltimore so that he can preserve the union. And finally, at one point, he gets disgusted and he said, you know, we used to be a country that made real things and did real things.
Right.
It's a great description of sort of, you know, a good local guy who's trying to stop the disinvestment and keep people focused on doing real things that are useful.
Well, let's get another Catherine west of the Rockies in Central Coast, California, on Coast to Coast AM for Catherine Austin Fitz. Go ahead, Catherine.
Good evening, both of you. I have a question for Catherine about trade. I know you're a domestic economist, but maybe you can answer this for me. Economists say that trade does not contribute to poverty, for example, in Mexico, where the corn price has gone so high. And what is your take on this? Is the direct result of trade the increase in prices and the relative poverty of the lower group of income people?
Well, whether trade increases poverty or decreases poverty really has to do with how it's done. And what I would do is encourage you to take a look at the world through the lens not of trade or not trade, but of economic warfare, because the way that trade policy is being managed is really to help consolidate and centralize the economy, you know, in different countries and regions. So, for example, we crash credit in Asia during in 97 and then swoop in and buy the equity cheap and then proceed to invest. Or we go into the Middle East in a warfare mode, you know, basically shift ownership of who owns what and then start to bring in government contracts. So you really want to look at things more in an economic warfare basis. And trade is often used, or pro-trade language is often used, to justify those kind of economic warfare policies when what is going on is something else.
As you hear them in any of these debates, do any of the candidates for president, Democratic or Republican, do either of them, do any of them do anything for you in terms of what you think needs to be done for the economy?
Ian, I don't watch the debates. I'm much too busy.
Okay, well, that's fine. So do you follow in any way? Do you think any of them are qualified to be able to fix this problem?
Well, I don't think that's the role of a presidential candidate who's backed by big money. And I think their role, it's no different than watching a football game, but their role is to basically obfuscate what's going on and to make it look like there's some kind of democracy or consensus, which there's not.
And we'll leave it there with Catherine Austin Fitz. Oh, except to ask, if in light of housing prices right now, would you buy a house right now? In light of how low they're going, would you buy that?
Not yet. I'd wait.
Okay. There you go. Thank you. It's always a pleasure. Thanks for
always
jumping on.
Always a pleasure, Ian.
Appreciate your perspectives on all of these economic stories, and wish you success, too, with your website and your blog and all of the other things. You can link up to Catherine Austin Fitz through our website at coasttocoastam.com. Michael D'Antonio. Love this storyteller. Love what he did with the real-life American Willy Wonka in his story, his biography of Hershey. And this is just as much fun. It's the 1957 story of the early space race, a ball, a dog, and a monkey. Next on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett.